Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello and welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. I'm Alan Saunders. This week, we're talking to a man who teaches philosophy to the business leaders of tomorrow. Robert Spillane is a professor at the Macquarie Graduate School of Management in Sydney, and he's written a book called An Eye for an Eye, Living Philosophy. Now, he teaches management, and he's written a book on philosophy. So what gives?
I've been teaching in a management school for 35 years, and I was trained in psychology, which I taught for many years, but the more I got into psychology, the more I found philosophical questions emerging, and the students started to take bets in each lecture that I might never move beyond the philosophy before I got to the psychology. So I ended up introducing to our MBA program a philosophy course, which, as far as we know, is the only MBA program in the world that requires our students to do philosophy.
How do you approach it? Do you approach it by the way of, as it were, doctrines of the great philosophers, or do you approach it by way of problems, perhaps the sort of problems that might engage somebody who was in business or management?
The school takes the position, and I support them in this, that if we are serious about preparing men and women for community leadership, they should understand the intellectual tradition from which they come. And so it's my job, essentially, to teach a history of Western ideas. So we start with Homer, a poet, of course, and we conclude with the French existentialism of Sartre.
Right, so it's not at all problem-based. You don't say, you know, these are the ethical issues which might face you if you were in a management position.
No, I teach a series of developing perspectives, and I select a philosopher to represent that perspective. So Greek rationalism is represented by Plato. Machiavellianism is obviously represented by Machiavelli. Empiricism by David Hume. So I'm linking the perspective to a representative of that perspective. But also there's an historical dimension in that I'm trying to show how these ideas evolved by attempts to answer or argue against their predecessors.
And do the students appreciate it? Is it a popular course?
Market research shows it's the best remembered and most discussed course in the MBA, but there's a love-hate relationship with it, and many of my students tell me that they can't see the point, they don't see the relevance, they wish they were studying finance. But it's interesting in that halfway through the course, the penny drops for many, if not most students, because they start to realise that the world can be interpreted through diverse perspectives, and that includes the world of management. And so they start realising that their cherished beliefs and their prejudices are being challenged by these politically incorrect writers.
Okay, well, let's move on to your book. I said it was called An Eye for an Eye, but perhaps you can tell us how that's spelt and what it means.
It's spelt an E-Y-E for an I, the pronoun I. And while some philosophers take the position that I is nothing more than a pronoun, and thus we shouldn't worry too much about what I actually is, the history of philosophy is a history of wrestling with this notion. What is I? And of course in English we have a variety of words for that. Ego, self, psyche, character, personality. And so the theme that keeps the book together, so to speak, is this search for this elusive I. Insofar as psychologists think that they're scientists, they tend to be studying human behaviour. But I think philosophy has always been fascinated by the notion of what is behind that behaviour. Is it a mind? Is it a self? Is there such a thing? How does one even go about answering questions about I?
Well, the way you go about answering these questions is that you go through various ways of living. You have chapters called Living Rationally, Living Mindedly, Living Skeptically, and so on. Do we have to choose one, or do they potentially represent different aspects of one person's life or being?
Well, this is itself a very interesting philosophical topic. Many people think that there is or should be a single, undifferentiated I, the essence of what we are, the string that holds the onions upon it, so to speak. Others, of course, think that the whole question is ill-conceived, that there is no such thing as an I. In our postmodern world, perhaps, we're inclined to follow Nietzsche. His thesis is that I is a multiplicity, that we are many eyes, that they are in a constant struggle for supremacy. Whether that view is coherent or not, I'm not sure, but at least it's worth pursuing. So I build the notion of the book around a search for an answer to the question, what is I, through an analysis, or at least a discussion, of 11 different ways of living philosophically.
Now, it's a bit of a surprise in this context that you begin with living heroically. You begin with Homer and the heroes of the Iliad, because whatever else those guys were, they weren't really philosophical. They were men of action, and almost of nothing but action.
Indeed, whatever Homer was, or whoever Homer was, certainly not engaged in the philosophical enterprise, but I'm not that interested in demarcation disputes, I have to say, and what is interesting about the heroic tradition, apart from it re-emerging later in the Renaissance in Machiavelli, later in the 19th century in Nietzsche, in the 20th perhaps in existentialism, is that it acts as a contrast in that these men of action nonetheless had a very definite language, a language that was sparse with respect to abstractions. It was an action language. We might later call it a nominalistic language. They had no conception of a psyche in the spiritual sense of the word. They had no sense of a dualism between mind and body. And in that sense, you might say that Western philosophy took its beginnings by an attack upon that tradition. And Plato was quite clear in the Republic that he would ban Homer from his utopia.
Well, yes. Now let's move on to the idea of living rationally. And here we get the notion, don't we, that the age of heroes is past and things are starting to get a bit introspective.
Indeed. The language becomes more abstract. There is less emphasis on action and more emphasis on reflection. There is less emphasis on courage and heroic deeds and much more emphasis on argumentation, on deductive reasoning. And I can quite understand Nietzsche's comment made in the 1880s that the great debate, the genuine antagonism in Western thinking, is the debate between Homer and Plato. Nietzsche is perhaps in the minority when he goes on to say that Homer was a glorifier of life and Plato a slanderer of life. And it seems that Nietzsche never forgave Socrates for replacing as a cultural hero the warrior with a person whose virtue seems to be that they can argue other people into the ground.
Well, yes, and as well as that, we get with Socrates the notion that you have to know yourself. Now, presumably Homer's heroes didn't know themselves because the question didn't really arise in those terms.
The question didn't arise. You were in heroic society, as indeed you still are, the sum of your actions. And your actions in Homer are largely determined by the role that you occupy, with, I admit, some interference from 55 gods. When Socrates says, know thyself, there's of course some debate as to whether that's a psychological statement or whether he's saying, know your place in the cosmos, or know your place in society. Because as the book makes clear, the notion of an individual set against society could well have developed much later. But Socrates, I think, is important, not so much just for his rationalism, but that he does add a cynical and sceptical element in Western thinking, which, of course, was picked up by the cynics and by the sceptics.
Yes, I mean, Socrates meets somebody who says, I'm going to the courts to pursue justice. And then he says something like, what is justice? The guy then gives examples of just actions, and Socrates says, no, that's not what I meant. I mean, what is justice? You can see how he would have annoyed the hell out of people.
Well, he annoyed them to such a degree, as is well known, that he was found guilty of introducing false gods and subverting the youth of Athens. I think the first charge was invalid, the second was valid. And one can well understand, after a discussion with Socrates, the youth of Athens going back to their parents and saying, well, Socrates really says that whenever you mention courage, justice, love, you really don't know what you're talking about. And of course, this is the whole issue that sets Western philosophy running, this analysis of abstractions. What is justice with a capital J?
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Philosopher's Zone, and I'm talking to Robert Spillane, a professor at the Macquarie Graduate School of Management, about his book An Eye for an Eye. Now, I don't want to go doggedly through every way of living mentioned in Robert Spillane's book. I want to get to the revival of the heroic ideal, but let's go there by way of scepticism.
Well, there is a sceptical element in Socrates, as I've already suggested, and the wags tend to suggest that Socrates wasn't executed, rather he committed suicide, having been offered exile and declined, chose to go to the other world, for the main reason that it is in the other world that the answers to such questions as what is the essential meaning of a moral concept will be found. The sceptical element seems to be that he never appeared to accept any answer to the question, what is the essential meaning of a moral concept? And scepticism then develops by picking up on his famous quote that after a life of philosophizing, I now know that I know nothing. The sceptics, of course, said he couldn't even know that. It was, I think, Bertrand Russell's conclusion that extreme scepticism is for lazy people and that it is ultimately self-refuting and thus pointless. The academic approach to scepticism, which re-emerges, of course, in the great work of David Hume in the Enlightenment, wasn't that dogmatic, and at least believed that certain propositions could be held to be necessarily true, for example, tautologies, and that other propositions could be held to be contingently true. In that sense, they were prepared to accept the evidence of the senses. And I think the great debate in scepticism is the extent to which one is prepared to accept, at least to a degree, everyday evidence that is processed through the five senses.
Hume, though, in the 18th century, was still too sceptical for a lot of people of his age. I mean, they were terribly troubled by his scepticism and also, of course, by his atheism. Now, it is in the attempt to deal with the disturbing effects of Hume's philosophy that we find a sort of anti-18th century Enlightenment gathering force, which eventually comes to allow us to, as you put in your book, live romantically. Now, living romantically doesn't mean sort of swooning and falling in love. And in fact, the father of romantic philosophy, though he wouldn't have wanted to be, was somebody who, as far as I know, was never in love, Immanuel Kant. Tell us about him.
Well, as is widely known, Kant read David Hume and said that he was immediately awoken from his dogmatic Newtonian slumbers. Many have since said in the British tradition that it didn't take him long to go back to sleep again. But what he was trying to do was to meet Hume's scepticism head on. And just to take one example, Hume had shown that there was no way to demonstrate the validity of causation, and that one could not, through the senses, arrive at any evidence for causation. Kant inverted the situation and said the very good reason for that is that we impose causation upon the world, that the world is not there just to be discovered, that we are not passive receptacles in which the world imprints itself upon us as ideas. That whole position had led to a basic problem, that if all we know of the world are ideas of the world, and all we know are ideas, and thus we're led into a solipsistic impasse. And Kant's contribution, at least the positive side of it, was to suggest that the empiricist project, that we are passive receivers of stimuli, is false, and that we must understand the world as relatively less structured, and that the structure and meaning that we find therein is because we're imposing structure and meaning upon the world.
This is a version, isn't it, of what the Australian philosopher, the late David Stove, called the worst argument in the world.
Indeed it is, and the worst argument in the world, very, very popular today in postmodern universities, is essentially that we can only understand the world insofar as we perceive it through our perceiving apparatus, which of course is a tautology and thus true. Therefore, we cannot understand the world as it really is. And this led Kant into yet another two-world model. We see these two-world models in Plato, we see them in Descartes. Hume attempted to eliminate the two-world idea, but Kant returns to it, so that the argument is that since we structure the world, for example, in time, space, and causality, therefore the world as it really is must be timeless, spaceless, causeless. I think David Stove's point of view was that if there even was any logical justification in talking or surmising that there is a second world, about that world we can say absolutely nothing. And I think here is an echo of Wittgenstein, not that David had a lot of time for Wittgenstein, but Wittgenstein said, what you can say clearly, and what you can't say, we should pass over in silence.
Yes.
To which Frank Ramsey said, well, what he really means is, what you can't say, and you can't whistle it either.
Yes, that's F.P. Ramsey, the early 20th century British philosopher.
Who died tragically young.
Very young, yes.
I think David Stove's view is that it's a very, very bad argument, because it supposes that there is another world, that Kant had said we can know virtually nothing of that world, but then proceeds to populate it with spirituality, with gods or God, with freedom.
Now, the German philosophers who came after Kant were in search of the Ding an sich, the thing in itself, which is to say the thing not perceived through our senses, but the actual thing, whatever the thing might be. And in Fichte, this search leads to an approach that really almost takes us back to Homer's heroes, doesn't it?
Fichte is very interesting and unjustly neglected, I believe, because he was attempting to eliminate this two-world problem in Kant, though he wanted to stay in the spirit of the Kantian project. And to do this, he thought that the thing in itself was will. But Fichte combines this, as you correctly say, with a heroism, that if the world is the creation of my will, then what is in the world is not will. So I am, in fact, will. Now, to be fair, he does go further and talk about a universal will, which got him into trouble on charges of atheism, and which some people in the Christian tradition interpret as God. But nonetheless, we start from the proposition that I am will. What is not will resists my will and is thus to be overcome. And this notion of a perpetual overcoming of resistances and obstacles gives, you might say, the central motif to Romanticism. And again, it is certainly, as you say, not to be confused with some form of sentimentalism. On the contrary, Romanticism in its German form is really a philosophy of Titanism, a philosophy of mastery. And Fichte's little book of lectures called Addresses to the German Nation, which was rallying the Germans to fight Napoleon, was widely read by the German soldiers in the trenches. And it's certainly an extremely aggressive, heroic, will-based philosophy of mastery.
Well, once you turn the attention to the will, you can talk about using your will to overcome obstacles. But on the other hand, you can also talk about using your will to make choices. And that really brings us to the last chapter of your book, which is called Living Existentially. Tell us about the existentialists.
It's certainly true that the existentialists interpret will more in the sense of choice. And this is explicit, of course, in the work of Sartre, who says that because we are human, we are conscious by definition, that consciousness is not a thing. If it was, it would be determined by other things. It is therefore a no-thing. As a no-thing, it is free. That we are thus free to choose, and since it is we who are choosing, we are thus responsible for our choices. And existentialism, of course, was very popular in the 1940s. But interestingly, Sartre said around about 1945 that he didn't believe that existentialism would survive the decade because it is too tough-mindedly optimistic. It's optimistic because we are free to choose and thus to create the person we want to be. It's tough-minded because we're responsible for those choices. And whilst many people want freedom, they don't want the responsibility that goes with it.
Well, he was right, wasn't he, if we look at the world today?
He was right, and it's interesting that existentialism did pass into intellectual history in the 1950s and was replaced in the 60s by a return of Freud and of Karl Marx, which is a deadly cocktail. But the thing that Marx and Freud share is that they're both what I call victim philosophers. They hold that we are not existentially free. If we're not free, we're not responsible. And we're not free in Marx because of our position in the class system and capitalism. We're not free in Freud because of the traumas of our early childhood. And thus, you have a double philosophy of unfreedom. Now that, of course, in its turn has given way to postmodernism in the late 60s and 1970s. And I have to confess that I've made some fairly disrespectful comments in the book about postmodernism. I don't see it as philosophy. I see it as an anti-philosophy. And of course, insofar as postmodernists can agree on what they believe, they seem to agree that there is no truth, which means they're stating a truth. And they seem to agree that there are no facts, and they're stating a fact. And this self-reflexive problem becomes so serious that it's very hard to see how postmodernism can be called a philosophy.
I noticed that you hijack the French literary critic Roland Barthes into the postmodernist pack, and I was slightly taken aback by that because I hugely respect Barthes as a writer, and I don't think you could at all call him a postmodernist.
Well, nobody can agree who are postmodernists, and Derrida said he wasn't, and I think if he wasn't, then nobody is. I think as far as Roland Barthes is concerned, I share your views to some degree, but I argue vehemently against the death of the author thesis, and I quoted him in that context. I think if David Stove were around, he would want to take those words quite literally. And I think David might say, and here I'm in following in his spirit, that when an author says the author is dead, there's a major problem since he's saying it.
Well, this interview, I think, is going to have to die now. The book is called An Eye for an Eye, and let me remind you that it's EYE for an eye, the perpendicular pronoun, An Eye for an Eye, Living Philosophy. It's by Robert Spillane, and it's published by Michelle Anderson Publishing. Robert Spillane, thank you very much for joining us.
It has been a pleasure.
The show is produced by Polly Rickard, with technical production this week by Janita Palmer. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll be back next week with another Philosopher's Zone.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.